Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Procter & Gamble makes laundry detergent and toothpaste. It makes diapers and pet food. As of today, it's going to stop making drugs, news that could be a muscle relaxant for the credit crisis. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
American Public Media presents After the Bell, a weekly podcast that makes sense of the week in business and the economy, available at marketplace.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, the 24th of August today. Great to have you here. Procter & Gamble, proud purveyor of household staples like Tide and Crest, also has a huge prescription drug operation. It's a multi-billion dollar part of P&G's bottom line, but it never really caught on like the company had hoped. So today, the Irish pharmaceutical firm Warner Chilcott announced it's going to pay just over $3 billion to take drugs off P&G's hands. Perhaps most interesting, though, is what the P&G deal says about M&A, mergers and acquisitions. It's been a while since lenders have been financing these kinds of purchases like they used to. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
Money for companies to buy other companies has been scarce for the last year.
Across the board, lenders have been real gun-shy.
Ken McFagin is editor of the Mergers and Acquisitions Journal. He says caution in the marketplace kept Procter & Gamble from getting as much money as it wanted for its drug company.
I think they did sell it for less than they might have hoped for in a good market.
The sale is expected to be worth about $3 billion for P&G.
I would say in a normal market, they almost could have gotten double that amount.
But McFagin sees the deal as a heartening harbinger for the banking industry.
That's a good sign to see that the lenders are active again.
A consortium of banks funded the deal to the tune of $4 billion. That includes money for the buyer, Warner Chilcott, to pay down debt. V. Paul Monga covers mergers and acquisitions for The Deal magazine.
The fact that the banks are willing to do this suggests that their risk appetite is returning.
But that appetite for risk is still a fairly restricted diet. Monga says banks have viewed drug companies as almost recession-proof cash machines, funding several massive pharmaceutical mergers last spring.
The banks were willing to put out the money because of the amount of cash flow that Warner Chilcott generates and the fact that it was a healthcare deal. I don't think they would have been putting out $4 billion for a transportation deal, for example.
He expects to see a wave of mergers as companies gobble up their weaker rivals at bargain prices, but he doesn't expect momentum to really pick up until next year. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Talk show host Glenn Beck returns to the airwaves tonight on the Fox News Channel. He's been on vacation, but while he's been away, a lot of his advertisers have left him. The mass exodus stems from Beck's comment last month calling President Obama a racist. Didn't take long for protests to get started, some of which demanded companies stop buying ad time on Beck's show. Walmart, CVS, and Sprint have done just that, and others are taking it to a whole new level. They want out of the cable news talk show echo chamber altogether. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports.
If you've been out of the cable news loop recently, here's just a taste of what you're missing.
Come on, you coward!
And you're carrying a goddamn gun at a presidential event.
And I have to apologize, Professor, but I think you're a complete idiot.
Okay, maybe I cherry-picked the sound bites a little, but that's just the part of these talk shows that advertisers are afraid of. Ira Berger is director of national broadcasting with the ad firm The Richards Group.
I think advertisers from the beginning of time are not interested in controversy. They're interested in selling their product.
And he says the advertisers don't lose much by backing away from the primetime cable news shows.
I can't think of very many clients that are that dependent on a news audience. I mean, you can reach those people in other places.
Arizona State University professor Aaron Brown knows the world of TV news well. He used to anchor a show on CNN. He says for advertisers,
you know, the only thing worse than being on a program that's controversial is being on a program that no one watches.
Brown says traditionally advertisers have flocked to news to get a little cachet. But he says,
we're not talking about newscasts here. We're talking about talk shows. And they have never been considered to be classy.
So what if the advertisers all pull out? Here's Dan Kennedy, who teaches journalism at Northeastern.
Maybe they'll try news. Wouldn't that be an innovation?
Nah, too obvious. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Yes, it's the last week of August and most of Washington is on holiday, but the lobbying industry is still hard at work. Today, the oil industry's campaign against the climate legislation that's working its way through Congress heated up a bit. The industry's chief lobbying group, that would be the American Petroleum Institute, came out with a study of the climate bill's cost to U.S. refiners and perhaps eventually to consumers, too. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton reports.
The study predicts that if federal climate legislation becomes law, increased production costs would force U.S. refiners to slash output nearly 20%, and the resulting shortfall would cause imports of gas and diesel to double, jeopardizing U.S. energy security. John Felmy is the American Petroleum Institute's chief economist.
Clearly, these findings show that you could characterize this action as being all pain and no gain.
But the golden rule of economic models is that the results are only as good as the assumptions that go into them. And in this case, the study's authors assume little to no growth in alternative technologies like carbon sequestration and nuclear energy. They also base their findings on the assumption that the U.S. would be the only country to pass restrictions on greenhouse gas emissions, making it cheaper to refine gasoline overseas.
This is the ultimate example of garbage in, garbage out.
Daniel Weiss is with the liberal think tank Center for American Progress. He says industry-backed economic studies with dire predictions are common practice among businesses opposed to increased regulation.
By making an assumption that is extremely unlikely to occur, gives them the output that they want, which is that it will be terrible for their industry.
The American Petroleum Institute's study did include a separate scenario not mentioned in this press release. That one used Department of Energy data that assumed wider adoption of low-carbon technologies. The result was a slight rise in U.S. refining production, despite major limits on greenhouse gas emissions. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
In case you're keeping track, crude oil touched a 10-month high today before settling at $74.37 a barrel. No such progress in the stock markets. The major indices meandered most of the day. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Senior citizens and others who get Social Security checks have come to count on something called a COLA, a cost of living adjustment. It's a yearly bump in their checks tied to inflation. Come January, though, the COLA is going to be decidedly flat since the recession has put the brakes on inflation. But Marketplace's Tamara Keith reports now from Washington that not everybody measures their cost of living the same way.
Social Security payments to seniors normally increase a little bit every year. In 2010, the Social Security trustees project there will be no increase at all. That's because Social Security payments are tied to the Consumer Price Index, and that's down from where it was last year, in part because of the dramatic drop in gas prices. But 67-year-old Barbara LaBelle says her cost of living hasn't come down. Take her medical expenses.
They've raised my co-pays, and now I pay for lab work, which I didn't have to pay before. So as many doctors as I'm seeing, I'm shelling out high copays.
Her experience points to a problem many seniors face. Healthcare costs are rising a lot faster than the rate of inflation. Christina Martin Fervita is with AARP.
They count on that cost of living increase to help them meet those healthcare expenses that continue to rise each and every year.
So advocates are pushing Congress to help seniors out with the cost of living adjustment, or COLA, anyway. Sandy Wise is with the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Here's what the committee wants.
Give either some kind of modest COLA increase to help people out in this situation, or just a flat payment, one-time payment, to compensate them for the lack of a COLA.
Barbara LaBelle's only source of income is her $900 a month Social Security check, and she'd love to get a raise, one way or another. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
Imagine if your chosen profession was the subject of heated, sometimes really heated, arguments across the country, that people were debating how much you should get paid or whether some of the tests you run are really necessary, or whether those white coats you wear are just so much window dressing and ought to be done away with. Jill Barshay reports now on the latest problem for doctors.
Peter Ragusa is a fourth-year medical student. It was obvious to him that his sleeves were rubbing against sick patients and spreading germs. But when Ragusa proposed getting rid of the traditional white doctor's coat, he was laughed out of the annual meeting of the American Medical Association.
Unfortunately, it was somewhat dismissive. You know, what will physicians be wearing in the future? You know, will they be scantily clad, et cetera?
Ragusa's proposal wasn't so racy. He called for short sleeves and no ties or jewelry. But it touched a nerve. Steven Greenberg is a medical historian at the National Institutes of Health. He says doctors have clung onto their white coats since the 1880s to be taken seriously as scientific professionals instead of quacks.
It's as much sociology as medicine. I'm the doctor. I have status. I have a uniform that makes me official.
The irony is that the status of the white coat has already slipped ever since nurses began wearing them. The more senior the nurse, the longer the coat, just like a doctor's.
But now everybody wears a white coat in a hospital. The cafeteria people, the librarians, the intake clerks, everyone wears a white coat. So the idea of, hi, I'm in a white coat, I'm the doctor, has kind of gone away.
Still, doctors are a sentimental bunch. White coat ceremonies are a rite of passage at medical schools. Just ask Arlene Miller, the owner of Jaw Mill Uniform Company in New York. She's been selling white coats for 47 years.
If it's someone that never had a lab coat before, it's like a wedding dress. They try on everything they can. What else you got? You know? So
the uniform industry is attached to white coats, too. 5 months ago, Landau, one of the largest manufacturers, started selling coats with long sleeves, made of a new material that resists germs. But Peter Ragusa may still get the last laugh. The American Medical Association is studying his proposal. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay for Marketplace.
There's no shortage nowadays of ideas for how to bring down the high cost of medical care. There's mandatory universal coverage, or a government-backed insurance option, or changing the way doctors are paid, all of which are incredibly complicated problems. Dr. Lisa Sanders says we ought to be looking more at the point where patients first enter the medical system, that initial diagnosis in the doctor's office. Dr. Sanders writes the column Diagnosis in the New York Times Sunday magazine. She's an advisor to the Fox medical drama House, and she has a new book out. It's called Every Patient Tells a Story. Dr. Sanders, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for inviting me. It's great to be here.
Do me a favor and place the art of diagnosis in the context of the current healthcare debate.
Diagnosis is by far the most important step in figuring out what kind of resources are going to be expended on a single patient. You get the diagnosis right away, you're thoughtful about it and don't order tests like crazy, and then you only do one therapy. If you don't get the diagnosis right, then every patient is a replay of House MD, where you come up with a million kabillion-dollar tests, use a kabillion dollars worth of therapy, and maybe not get the right answer until 50 minutes into the show.
Yeah, I read someplace that the most expensive piece of equipment in medicine is the doctor's pen.
Absolutely. And yet the most effective piece of equipment is also the doctor's pen. I mean, it just depends on how it's used.
So what's the best way then to get the art of diagnosis more effective and more well performed?
Well, first of all, I think the doctors need to have more time. Now, you know, a doctor is free to make his schedule any way he wants. He can schedule his most of the time, can schedule his appointments for as much time as it takes. And yet, he has to see enough patients to pay for the building, to pay for the nurses and the medical assistants. And, you know, he's a small business or sometimes part of a larger business, and they have their financial needs. And so the only way to give doctors more time is to pay them enough so that they can see fewer patients. We pay doctors to do. We do not pay them to think. And yet thinking is what's going to give us the best outcome and the most cost-effective outcome.
Hmm. One of the points you make in this book is that a really good investment for us to make would be to beef up primary care, that that would help not only bring healthcare costs overall down, which is, you know, what this whole debate is about, but also help patients enormously. Explain that, would you?
Certainly. The doctor who knows you best is obviously the one who's going to be best able to understand your symptoms and the way you present your symptoms and how it fits into the bigger picture of your health. So I think that there's a strong case to be made that that's the best way to be treated. But you don't have to take my word for it. You can just look at every other industrial country on the planet, and you'll see all the ones that are ahead of us in line in terms of their outcomes and longevity, they all have a system that focuses on primary care.
The book you have written is a compilation, in essence, of diagnostic stories, of patient stories and the saga of figuring out what was wrong with that person. Is there one that's illustrative of the point we're trying to make here, that the importance of the art of diagnosis and primary care can really save you money in the long run?
Absolutely. There's a patient of mine, I'll call him Charlie, who, 65 years old, spent most of his life outside the care of the medical system until one day he came in and he felt really bad, very ill. The nurse sent him to the emergency room when she found that his pulse was very, very slow. He had a huge workup that was seen by four doctors, two specialist cardiologists, was sent to the ICU. And when all was said and done, what had really happened was that his kidneys had shut down because he couldn't pee. He couldn't pee because of a very ordinary problem among men that age. His prostate had gotten too large and had cut off the urethra. But nobody really picked up on it. Nobody elicited the history, and nobody did the physical exam.
And you multiply that by tens of thousands of similar cases across the country, and pretty soon you're talking real money.
Now it's real money.
Lisa Sanders teaches at the Yale University School of Medicine. Her new book is called Every Patient Tells a Story, Medical Mysteries and the Art of Diagnosis. Dr. Sanders, thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, what happens to you when the bottom drops out?
There was about a month where I was literally numb. I mean, I don't know, you know, my circuits were trying to recalibrate to the situation.
But first, let's do the numbers. If you saw the open today, you pretty much saw the close. The Dow Industrials gained 3 whole points, closed essentially flat at 95.09. The NASDAQ fell 2 points, 0.1%, 2017 at the end of the day. The S&P 500 lost 0.5 point. Again, basically flat, 1,025 there. Bank stocks sank after SunTrust Bank said lenders still face more credit losses. Also, commercial real estate could stumble through next year. SunTrust fell 3.25% today. Wells Fargo trotted down 2.2%. J.P. Morgan Chase lost 1.5%. Best Buy did not look like one to investors spooked about consumer stocks. The company unloaded 4.5% today. Ford Motor died down 4.25%. Wyndham Worldwide emptied out 3%. Looks like investors are holding their breath in advance of a slew of numbers coming out this week, from consumer confidence to consumer spending, new home sales. Oh, and also stuff like second quarter GDP. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business. www.batteninstitute.org. We've got all the business news worth talking about on our new blog. Scott Jagow hosts the Marketplace Scratch Pad. You can check in with him throughout the trading day at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The Conference Board releases the Consumer Confidence Index for August. Weather permitting, Space Shuttle Discovery will blast off headed for the International Space Station. It is loaded with supplies, including a piece of exercise equipment named after comedian Stephen Colbert, the Colbert. That's Combined Operational Load-Bearing External Resistance Treadmill. And writer-director Tim Burton turns 51. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. We tend to hear a good amount from economists on this program, analyzing the news of the day, interpreting statistics for us, or looking at consumer behavior. Rarely, though, do we hear them talk about what they do when they're not on the job. What they do, in other words, for fun. We asked around a little bit, and the sad answer is that even when they're not working on economics, a lot of economists are still thinking about it. We start a week's worth of Econ Fun 01 commentaries today with Susan Lee.
If addictions can be considered fun, then I have a biggie. I'm addicted to the TV series Two and a Half Men. It's about two bachelor brothers. The handsome one, Charlie, lives in a three-bedroom house in Malibu, on the beach. He drives a Mercedes. He has a housekeeper. He goes out to dinner all the time, and he never seems to work, except for the time he slept with his neighbor who gave him a Steinway Baby Grand. The nerdy brother, Alan, lives with Charlie. He drives a poopy car. He has to sponge off Charlie to buy popcorn at the movies. Yet he works very hard as a chiropractor. Once, he even had to take a second job to pay his alimony. It's real-world economics turned upside down. Charlie the slacker has everything, while Alan the worker bee has almost nothing except a giant penny jar. Anyway, the show is very funny. If you're feeling really silly, you can find yourself laughing every 2 minutes. Unless you're a priggish economist like me. For instance, I'm totally grumpy about Charlie's giant amount of disposable income. His life seems to be one big fat windfall gain. However, according to economic theory, windfall gains are mostly saved, not spent. Yet Charlie spends his money furiously. But wait, I say to myself, maybe Charlie is borrowing to finance his lifestyle. No, I argue, nobody's going to lend money to a slacker like Charlie. Or wait, Charlie gambles a lot on sports. Maybe he wins big, too. Nah, unlikely. Most bettors are losers because bookies' odds are set pretty efficiently. Well, my economist self usually debates with my silly self right through the first 20 minutes of the show, and so both selves miss 10 or 11 really good jokes. Worse, if other people are watching and I'm yelling out complaints, they miss the jokes, too. But maybe that's the function of economists, to take the fun out of life. Ah, I feel so much better.
Susan Lee is an economist in New York City. We would like to hear from you no matter where you live. Write to us at our webpage. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. This isn't something a lot of people like to admit, but a good part of the way we see ourselves, how we identify ourselves, is shaped by how much we have. The cars we drive, the vacations we take, the number of zeros in front of the decimal point on our bank statements. That goes for the rich, the poor, and the in-between, too. It's a pretty safe bet that most of us have less these days, and we wanted to see whether big losses made a difference for those who still have a lot. Ashley Milne-Tite reports that even for the super rich, their identity takes a beating when their portfolios do.
No matter how much money you have, just thinking about losing some seems to make life harder to bear. Kathleen Voss is a marketing professor at the University of Minnesota. She and her colleagues have done experiments where they asked some students to make a list of what they spent the previous month. Others were asked to write about the weather. Afterwards, the students plunged their hands into very hot water or played a game where they were made to feel left out.
And we were interested to see whether being reminded of money that you don't have anymore would change people's experiences of pain. And it did. It made people feel that those painful experiences were even more painful.
Big financial setbacks, like we've seen in the past year, aren't something the super wealthy want to talk about, at least not publicly. But they do talk to Russ Prince. His market research firm studies people with at least $50 million. He says men, and it is mostly men, lose more than money when they lose money. Their sense of self can get lost too. Prince knows one very successful businessman who'd been traveling by private jet for 30 years. Then he lost tens of millions and had to start flying commercial.
Now, remember, he has a handful of instructions. This guy has made a fortune managing businesses and commanding other people and directing. He couldn't find the plane. The plane left without him.
Prince says the experience was so unnerving, the man flies as little as possible now. Then there's the guy who lost $100 million recently, half his net worth. He still has another $100 million, but Prince says the man saw himself as invincible before, not any longer.
Impotence was the first problem. Erratic behavior soon followed, and drinking picked up afterwards.
Alden Cass is a psychologist with a practice in Manhattan. He sees a lot of Wall Street traders, music moguls, and other competitive types who are struggling now.
It's about learning how to emotionally deal with times when your reality does not meet up with your expectations. And that's where you need to learn how to look at things from different perspectives, healthier perspectives.
Cass trains clients to think positive. He calls his technique bullish thinking, so they can ride out the bad times without sinking into addiction or depression. Then there are those who appear unaffected by their loss. Take Josh Harris. He's an internet entrepreneur who made around $80 million in the late 90s. He bought a loft in Manhattan and two farms in upstate New York. But during the next several years, he spent every penny of his fortune on two startup companies and some experimental art projects. Now he's broke and living in his friend's pool house in L.A.
There's the jacuzzi, and here's the pool. You know, I do spend a bit of time sunning and getting my laps in.
Harris says what he misses most about being rich is smoking the finest Cuban cigars. He says he never wanted to live like a rock star. Still, losing everything was a shock.
There was about a month where I was literally numb. I mean, I don't know, you know, my circuits were trying to recalibrate to the situation.
Harris says he's learned to live with his new reality, for the most part. He's in his 40s now and wants to get married, but he says to do that, he needs money. How much?
My number's around 20. After taxes.
Hang on, are you saying you need to have $20 million before you can, quote, find a wife?
No, but it's sort of, maybe. Yeah, I'll say it. I need $20 million before I can find a wife.
He's setting up another company now and says he'll have that $20 million within 3 years. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, progress of sorts, I suppose. Video in your magazines. The September 18th edition of Entertainment Weekly is going to have special ad inserts inside. Subscribers in Los Angeles and New York, they're the only ones who are going to be getting it, will have their pick of a Pepsi ad or promos for the fall lineup at CBS.
Greetings, distinguished reader. I hope you're enjoying the current issue of Physics Today.
That was the guy from The Big Bang Theory, in case you couldn't tell. We'd play you more, but the sound was just really, really bad. The whole thing kind of reminded me of the moving newspaper pictures in Harry Potter. I don't know. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 3 points, basically flat. The Nasdaq lost 2 points, a tenth of 1%. The S&P 500 dropped a half a point, flat again. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Coming up next time on the broadcast, sowing new plans to feed the world.
We need to start taking care of our seeds and really handling them like they're gold. They're precious.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.